So what's happening on Saturday at Stork Tower?
So we have the reception, which is after all the other Class of 69 events are concluded. Reception from 5 till about 6:30. And that will be focused on the student media alumni from whatever year, current student media staff members or and interested parties, and Ledge Council from alumni from 68 to 70. So Paul Sweet and I kind of engineered putting this together, and I wanted to do a couple of pretty special things. Number one, I wanted to pay homage to the 50th year of the Stork Tower, Stork facility.
It's turning 50. Stork Tower is turning 50 this year. That's incredible.
Yeah. I was a general manager at the time and also chairman of communications board. And Vernon Cheadle, the chancellor, asked me if I would be the MC at the dedication, which was in March of 1969. Which on most calendars was a month ago in 10, 50 years.
Close enough, close enough. Was Mr. Stork there?
Tom Stork was there. Tom didn't die until a couple of years later. And Earl Warren. Does that name ring a bell?
Yeah, he was our senator, right?
He was U.S. Senator from California. He was governor of California. And then he was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
That's incredible. So those VIPs were there?
He had been good buddies with Tom Stork for many years.
Oh, no kidding.
The president of the university was there. I think it was Charles Hitch at the time. The chancellor and I were on the dais. That was it.
So what was it like seeing that tower go up? So were you were at KCSB when the tower was being built?
Oh, yeah. We helped design it. So a little backstory, and you stop me if it gets too complicated. KCSB was originally in Navajo. So it started from Navajo Hall and became popular basically as a big hi-fi, with a couple of pleas to the AS, which was then gaining strength. The AS had been kind of a marginalized activity since the move from downtown, from Riviera and Mesa campuses. And the AS was gaining strength and notoriety and, shall we say, a little swagger in doing its role and taking on responsibility for meeting the needs of the students. And at that time, there was no tuition at the university. We paid $15 per semester. That was before the quarter system. We paid $15 a semester for the associated students' student fees. And that's what funded the AS. Now, when we go back to 1963, 4, 5, when I arrived on campus in fall of 64, the student population was about 5,500 people. 5,500 times even 30 bucks a year is not very much money. So there wasn't much that the AS could do until Vernon Cheadle's dream, his vision, his gestalt for what the campus would be started to gain traction. And that took place beginning in 63 with some major construction and destruction of Marine Barracks buildings and gradual construction of new facilities for both for residential housing for students on campus, as well as expansion and, shall we say, is permanentizing a word? Or making permanent a number of the facilities for classrooms and laboratories.
So when you were here then, because this used to be the military base, when you were here, there were a lot of the Quonset Hut buildings still on campus?
Not Quonset Huts. They were all Lath.
Modular?
Lath, rectangular buildings, and there's still a couple out there on the east side.
Well, across from the Stork Tower, there's still one of those buildings, and that's where our AS Media Center is. Yeah.
Okay, so in late 64, late school year 64, which means spring of 64, the station moved from Navajo Hall to that facility. It's across the hall from Stork.
That must have been a huge, you're uptown now. You're right in the center of the university, going from the dorm to the university.
Yeah, we moved there, and El Gaucho moved there, La Cumbre, Spectrum.
Those were all the publications, all of the print publications?
All student media.
Okay.
And during that period, the AS hired Joe Kovac, who will be one of the speakers tomorrow. And Joe was hired as the publications director or something like that. He was basically adult supervision for the radio station and the newspaper.
Uh-huh.
And specifically the newspaper and the and the yearbook were selling advertising to the community. So Joe had some experience in those trade areas, and so Joe used both his intellectual capability and his interest in this stuff, plus some of his background in advertising sales. So Joe played a key role on that, and he came on board in 64, as I recollect. So Joe was important in that. He was kind of a paterfamilias for all the students running around. And it wasn't so much of a big task as it was reasonably chaotic. We, the student media, were all concerned about our own little missions, and very few people were taking on the broader perspective of relationship to the broader campus, to the Santa Barbara community, things like social and political and economic responsibility. Those were things that really evolved, from my perspective, beginning in the school year 64 and becoming much more important through the end of that decade.
So how were you running? How were you programming KCSB at that time? You probably didn't have that many programmers. What kind of content were you running on the air?
Well, it was what people would call folk music.
Anti-war music?
Christy Minstrel Singers. And
oh, wow.
Peter, Paul, and Mary. And I mean, that stuff was pretty avant-garde for anybody at that point. So we had a morning show that ran from 6 to 9, or 6 to 8:30 or something like that. Then we would sign off, and we would sign back on about 5 p.m., and we'd have a big newscast. And that would run for about 15 minutes to half an hour. And then we would play study music, classical music, for 3 hours or so, and then jazz at night. And we would shut down at midnight or so. That was one of the things that I changed when I became program director and later general manager. Back at that time that we're talking about now, which is 63, 64, and the school year 65, we were operating on what the Federal Communications called a construction permit. So we had written all of the application stuff, sent it into the FCC, got a blessing from the regents and a blessing from the associated students, and that enabled us to apply for a real live radio license. At that time, we were the first and only FM station or radio station broadcasting to the rest of the community. The rest of the stations on the UC campuses were all carrier current. That is, they were sending signals around the campus dorms, and that was it.
So did you have your transmitter on broadcast peak at this point, or did the transmitter come later?
No, that's another one of the things I did. The initial transmitter was a piece of 4-inch iron pipe that is still on the side of East Hall, I believe it's East Hall of San Miguel, on the top of the building. So that was our first transmit facility. That ran we had a teapot transmitter, but it was basically a freebie that didn't really have all the capability that our system does now, of course.
How far did the signal go with that pipe on the side of the dorm?
It's just over the side of the SLU.
Huh.
You could get that signal into Ladera Heights. But beyond that radius, it was useless.
Where's Ladera Heights?
Just on the other side of the city line.
Okay.
The city county line.
That's amazing.
That was 63, 64, 65. We were actually on the air with the FM in early 64, but we didn't have a fully operating license. We just had this construction permit. So later in 64, I believe it was October 12th, we got the actual licensing from the Federal Communications Commission. And we were fortunate to get the call sign that we had requested, which was KCSB FM. And we called it the FM because we were running a KCSB AM at the same time inside the dorms. So we left that alone, and we were using what was called a simulcast, which is now a rare thing because of what the FCC has done. But regardless, we had both the carrier current AM to the dorms and the FM station operating simultaneously, same signal. When I became program director, which was 1966 or 67, something like that. I engineered a couple of changes. First, I had a new organizational structure for the station. Second, we needed more coverage in the Santa Barbara area. And my chief engineer at the time, Len Sibley, we drove around for probably close to a year looking for different hilltops, including the KEYT.
TV Hill, uh-huh.
Broadcast station where they are, in Hope Ranch, in several other places. And we couldn't find anything that was really good. Most of them were going to charge us for access, and most of them were good but not great. So we say, well, how come we're going to spend $20,000 a year to rent a piece of facility from these people, and it's not even the best we could do for 20 grand? So we kind of put that concept on the shelf. In the interim, we received through the fundraising and community support of Vernon Cheadle, a new transmitter, a brand new solid state, no joking around, real live transmitter. Brand new from Jack Mosley, Mosley Associates, there in Santa Barbara. And Jack had been very instrumental in working with KTMS, which is KTMS AM and FM, and the newspaper were co-owned by Tom Stork. And so we had a good relationship with Tom Stork through the chancellor and through Jack Mosley. Jack had been involved in building a new broadcast facility for KTMS's FM operation, which at that point was indeterminate as to whether it was going to be a separate operation like KTYD was. I know if they're still in existence. But
oh, yeah. They're the huge classic rock, 99.9. Yeah.
They wanted to position KTMS AM as a news and public affairs facility to distinguish it from KIST and from KDB and from CASEL, or CACL, as we sometimes call it, which would let the FM go off and sell its own radio time and theoretically become more profitable. So they did that for a year, and then it changed back to the way it was before. It was not very consistent. As I said, together and apart, together and apart. You know, it's no wonder they didn't build a real solid audience. We now had a brand new transmitter, and it worked great. Now it pumped a solid 10 watts out of our coat hanger at the top of San Miguel Hall. We used a new technique of orienting the antenna so that it was more comfortable with car radios and with little small radios sitting on your dorm desk, as well as if you've got a big antenna up in the air. So that's what's called circular polarization. So we our ring, our coat hanger on the top of the 4 foot, 4 inch pole was basically a ring. If you took a coat hanger and bent it around, it'd be like that. So that was that, and that's how we existed through probably late 65, calendar 65, early calendar 66. I became general manager. I became program director. And the things that we worked on were we were trying to get a new site for the antenna. And that died a morning. And then we became preoccupied with what's called the USEN, the University Center Building Number 1. Which was envisioned as this large complex of three or four buildings along the lagoon there. And this first one was had a relatively small eating area in the basement and classrooms, meeting rooms on the bottom and the second floors. Third floor was the AS offices, KCSB, El Gaucho, La Cumbre. Who else was there? Spectrum was there. A couple of the AS charities were there. So we had occupied the third floor pretty completely. Our existence there was very uncomfortable for Bob Lorden, who was at that time the executive director of the University Center and executive director of the Associated Students. So he was operating on a split salary. Some of it was from the university and some from the AS. So Bob's original gestalt, his perspective on the building was it would be a 9-to-5 building, except for cafeteria and maybe dances or things that they would run on weekends. Well, we didn't like that. KCSB, I had plans already to go 24 hours, which meant we're going to have people going in and out of that building all the time. I think the watershed was the Yom Kippur War in 67. That's when we felt an obligation to the community to be on the air 24 hours a day. We re-engineered the programming schedule. We instituted what's called block programming. So if you can envision a horizontal strip across every day of the week at, let's say, from 9 to noon. And we would have a certain kind of programming there. And again, unlike KTMS, for example, we're building consistency. So people knew that after their coffee break at 9 o'clock, they, whatever day it was, they're going to have the same programming.
That's how you work radio today, except for here on KCSB, because we're very eclectic now.
Well, we had our share of eclecticism. Certain day parts were very strongly architected with strong K-rails. So you got a two-lane road, and the K-rails are one on each side, and you know what your boundary conditions are. You can do whatever you want on the road, but you can't cross the boundary. So from basically 6 a.m. until 6 p.m., it was that kind of a hard structure, that predictable, horizontal, everyday structure.
But were you doing a lot of news? It sounds like, because you were mentioning you had the news in the morning.
Gosh, and we had a lot of news.
And were you, so you, were you doing news about the war? Were you doing activist type of stuff?
It was, I guess in perspective, it was activist stuff. I built a news team. I was news director the year before. I built a news team of 150 students.
That's incredible. 150 students.
Yeah, we had the largest broadcast news facility between Los Angeles and San Francisco. And we would cover stuff all over the state. We sent students with a tape recorder to regents meetings, no matter where they were. And we became, you know, a feature, an expected piece of furniture.
At all of those meetings, but that's incredible.
So we recorded the decisions and we brought them home or sent them over the UC tie lines back to the station, and we distributed them. And we said, you know, no comment. This is what the regents said. You make your own decisions.
Awesome.
That was kind of the gestalt, the whole perspective of KCSB News. We did a lot of live reporting. J.D. Strawler and a couple of other engineers built a remote studio in a briefcase, and we would take that and do remotes wherever we were. And the studio, that briefcase connected into a phone line, and we taught people how to connect into phone lines from wherever they were. Well, this was the beginning of first the UC radio network and later the Pacific College radio network, when the UC radio network was only UC campuses and was connected by the tie line system.
So this was mid-60s. How many UC radio stations were there? Because KCSB was the first.
First FM station.
Oh.
Not the first FM. The only non-carrier current station.
I gotcha. Okay.
What happened was KALX at Berkeley had been carrier current plus FM. And the university has lobbied for and received pretty substantial broadcast license for the Bay Area. And then with some of the upheavals in the early 60s, like 62, 64, some community member heard a nasty on the air.
Uh-oh.
And got mad at the regents and the chancellor and sent in letters and threatened. And the regents chose to shut down the FM.
Wow.
So they took it off the air. There remained a thriving carrier current operation, which operated on campus and to a couple of dorms that are immediately surrounding campus. Are you familiar with the Berkeley area at all?
Not so much. Berkeley?
Okay.
I know KALX, but I don't know. I haven't been there.
Okay. So that was Radio Cal. Who else was on the air?
KZSB at Santa
KLA
Cruz?
At UCLA had tried for years to find a path through the FCC rules that would let them go on the air in any way whatsoever. And they never found it. Because
they're still internet only.
Spectrum in Los Angeles is just full up. So they have a very thriving, commercially supported carrier current radio station at UCLA. And there was at that time also a station at KUCR, Cougar.
That's UC Riverside.
Yeah, at UCR, right, Riverside. The DVS folks at KDVS at Davis. So they were the backbone and we were the backbone. And we used to run a conference once a year, and we bring people from each of the stations in, and we talk about problems and issues and ways to do things. UC Radio Network was one of the things that came out of that.
And you know it still exists today. We have meetings twice a year. That's a really incredible resource.
We hosted it
here last year or the year before at here in Santa Barbara. And it's just a really great resource to have colleagues at other UC radio stations to talk. Yeah. Thank you for that.
We're familiar with other things like the slings and arrows of outrageous administrations. But it's a matter of being at the right time in the right place and knowing how to take advantage of opportunities. And that's what they did. So there was the UC stations, which we just enumerated. And later, UC San Diego built a station. And I would say, with all modesty, the compatriots at other UC campuses were very helpful to new stations that wanted to go on the air. We didn't see them as competitive issues. So then we discovered that there was stuff going on that wasn't exactly part of the UC system, but required coverage. And we had a point of view that it would be just too much self-aggrandizing. And obviously it should seem to others outside the system that we were being biased in favor of the system. So we reached out to some non-UC radio stations. The first to come in was Cal Poly and San Luis Obispo. And they did it because we had become very close with them. We had given them a bunch of old hardware and helped give them some ideas to help get them started. And then the second one was Stanford, KZSU. That started to broaden our field. We picked up an NPR station on an affiliate basis in Sacramento, which got us closer to, well, the north of the state, but also to the politics of the state of California.
So were you sharing content at this time? Would you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So we would have, this was before God invented email. So we would have to make phone calls from our news desk to the stations and tell them we now have this Regents meeting and we've headed it down to some pithy issues and the tape is available. Let us know if you want it. And if they wanted it, we would have to find them on the Tie Line network and play the tape back to them.
In real time. So they'd have to record it in real time on their end?
Yep. Huh. Yep.
Imagine that.
And this is through the UC Tie Line system, which is our origin in general telephone was terrible. So that's where we had our guys, our contacts at GTE, putting loading coils and doing other kinds of capacitor networks on our lines from the station to the Centrex office of GTE on campus. And that improved the quality a little bit. In fact, we didn't want to improve it. This is ex post facto justification, rationalization. We didn't want to make it too good because you wanted to make this sound like, well, this is the Samaning Eddie Fatursi calling from it. And it sounded like it was far away. that's sexy, right?
back then, okay.
So listeners would feel that they were part of an actuality. And, even though from WB, that unless the actuality sounds a little bit different than the tones you're getting from local announce, people don't really get it as being a separate and distinct thing. Part of my time I was for money, I was a stringer for UPI. Part of the quid pro quo was that UPI would let us broadcast stuff that also went to them because they weren't very well covered. They were mostly AP facilities in the Santa Barbara area. Mm-hmm. And since our signal didn't go past Santa Barbara, nobody cared. And UPI was very cooperative. And I don't know what the situation is now, but in those days, UPI staffers wrote better broadcast copy, whereas AP wrote the best newsprint copy.
Now that's interesting, but UPI isn't around anymore.
That's a shame. Mm. But we did look for something that would let our DJ announcers, the music program hosts, do a rip and read on a 5-minute newscast, which came in just before the top of the hour on the UPI broadcast line. So it was nice.
That is really, that's very organized of you, Michael Bloom. I mean, to be able to have all of the hosts do that and do that at the top of the hour, because that's something that we're working on incorporating here when we have emergencies like the storms or the fires, and it's training all of our programmers to be able to find the information that's needed and pass it along. So that's a project that's a long-term project here for KCSB.
It's really tough. And so what I did was when I was news director, so my career, I was just a staff guy for the first year, and I saw an opening, and I became news director the following year, and then program director, and then general manager. When I was news director, was organize each day of the week so that there was one individual who was the daily manager for that day for the news and public affairs. And he or she would be the locus point for all the news and public affairs programming, and responsible for training people, for giving them rules of the road, for putting up nasty notices on the window in front of the board, and just kind of pushing the ethos that was coming from my lips. And that included doing things like making sure that we did news and we did sports and weather, with the 5-minute newscast, and trying to make sure that the announcers read the copy before they would broadcast the copy.
Right. You need to practice it, right? Do a dry run. Make sure you can pronounce all of the words and stuff.
And see if it's relevant to your audience. I mean, you're on the air. You're getting phone calls. Is this copy relevant to your audience? Well, that was a big problem during the height of the Vietnam War, and in particular, the draft lottery. So we had to do a lot more screening and education within our own team to make sure that we didn't fall off the end of the earth, which meant we needed to be believable by both people who were inclined left and people who were inclined right.
So it really meant something to you to be neutral, to be presenting the facts and not presenting it with opinion.
Yeah, because we had plenty of opinion shows. We didn't need more of that. But we found out when somebody did a Nielsen in the area that we came out number one. This is only once, right? And found out that we were trusted for our news content.
That's amazing. So we're talking about 1965, 66?
65, 66.
So I do have to tell you, when I first moved to Santa Barbara 4 years ago, I would ask everyone what radio station they listened to, and more people told me KCSB than any other station. I know the station's changed a lot since you were here in the 1960s, but and I didn't even know about KCSB when I moved here. I moved here to work at another station. Was there activity in Isla Vista at that time? What kind of news were you covering in Isla Vista in the mid-1960s? This is before the Bank of America burned.
Well, we worked very closely with the local businesses in IV. Coffee shops. Is Borsodi still in existence?
No, I don't know that one. Okay. You didn't run any advertisements, right?
Oh, correct. But this was the Borsodi's was the premier coffee shop hangout in IV. Very avant-garde. And people would hang out there, and we would send us a couple of staff members with the remote briefcase and plug in, and Borsodi's would buy first we got free coffee, but they would buy some records for us or make a donation to the station or something. But it was not advertising. We were not doing like most stations are you're familiar with how you promote a remote when you're on site.
Right. Yeah.
We didn't do that. I mean, we would mention maybe twice an hour what we were doing when we did the station breaks.
So you would just talk to people who came into the coffee shop and what was going on, what's on your mind?
Oh, it was folk music is being played.
Okay.
Strong coffee. It was pretty mellow. Poetry reading.
So you would record the poetry reading and live folk music?
Broadcast it live.
Going on? Awesome. Broadcast it live. That's cool. So Michael Bloom, this is all, it's such interesting history about KCSB, and you are the class of 1969. You're coming to Stork Plaza tomorrow to honor the Stork Tower on its 50th birthday as part of the All Gaucho reunion. So we're going to be having some refreshments tomorrow at KCSB around 5 o'clock, 5 to 6:30, right? And the community is invited if they want to come.
Yeah, come on down. Well, we celebrate that stick in the air that has become an icon for the campus.
It sure has. And thanks to your dedication and support in gathering the news and overseeing this great entity that's KCSB. Thanks, Michael Bloom. I look forward to meeting you tomorrow.
My pleasure. Thank you.